In a recent comprehensive review of studies entitled If, Why, and When Subjective Well-Being Influences Health and Future Research Needed, researchers have concluded that there is often a connection between happiness and health. Here to tell us more is the lead author of the review, Professor Ed Diener, a psychology professor at the University of Utah. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Professor Diener.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be on.
Well, Ed, you and your team have managed to review quite a boatload of data, comprehensive studies on happiness and health, and it's a fascinating title, If, Why, and When Subjective Well-Being Influences Health. Tell us about your study, your review of the studies.
So, you know, I began this being a skeptic. I wasn't so sure. I had studied happiness, and I thought happiness is a good thing in that we want people to be happy and not depressed. But I never was sure that it was a good thing in other ways. That is, it had good outcomes. And then there were a lot of skeptics out there start saying, well, you know, people are too happy. They overlook problems in the world and so forth. So we started studying the outcomes of happiness. And one of those possibly was health. And I was a little skeptical because there were people around saying, oh, happy people were healthier. They live longer and so forth. But I wasn't a true believer. And so I started looking into all the literature. And now, this is, of course, 15 years later, it's absolutely overwhelming that your levels of happiness can influence your health. They do influence your health at times. And also, in the opposite end, of course, stress and anger probably influence your health in the other direction. So there's no doubt that it can and that it does frequently. Now what we're trying to do is figure out why, and we've done some of that. We figured that one reason that happy people are healthier is they're just much more likely to do healthy behaviors. So depressed people, angry people, less likely to exercise, less likely to use sunscreen, less likely to even use seatbelts in cars. Studies have been done on that. So we find in a whole series of health behaviors, happy people do them more, and therefore they're healthier and live longer. But we also find downward trends from happiness on the immune system, cardiovascular system, and now more and more research is coming out. You may have heard of telomeres, and some people say telomeres. It's said both ways, but that those end caps that protect our DNA and stress whittles those down and makes us age more quickly and leads to degrading when our cells multiply. So all the way down the line, we're finding that people's moods actually do influence their health. So now the question is, well, when is that more likely to occur, 20-year-olds, 80-year-olds, in cultures where they value happiness more and so forth? So we're looking into when it's stronger and when it's weaker, but pretty clear now that there is a connection.
That's great news, Ed. You know, it's, as you said, one of those intuitive notions we've sort of lived with for years that, well, if you're happy, you're healthier. You and your team have proven this is to be the case. You, I think, coined a new phrase, subjective well-being. If you could explain just what that...
Well, so we mean, you know, there's psychological well-being. You're in touch with reality. You're, you know, you're not mentally ill and so forth. But what we mean by subjective is, it's your opinion. You think your life is going great. You experience your life positively. You have more positive emotions. And actually, we find out that positive emotions and life satisfaction, those two both predict separately from negative emotions, the absence of negative, your health. And in fact, in many studies now, positive affect and life satisfaction predict more strongly than stress predicts in the negative direction. So we include all of those, and of course optimism can go in there too as part of subjective well-being, that is the person's well-being from their own perspective.
So it's not so much a physical doctor's chart or anything that's scientifically measuring, it's a individual's feeling about their oneself, their mental
health.
That's
right, and then we actually, of course, try to measure it accurately in different ways with both what people tell us, and then we try to validate that against brain measures and their behavior and what their family and friends say. So we've tried over the years to get measures that are more and more valid and also less biased, because obviously people could fool themselves or lie and so forth. So we've been working on the measurement quite a bit, and we think we're to the point where the measures are decent. They're as good as economic measures, perhaps, which is to say not perfect, but pretty good.
Ed, now, I looked at your study, and you spent quite a bit of time in and out of different research methods when you were in the process of review. You know, so many different studies you studied. What were some of the research methods that you explored, and why was it important to look at all the multiple?
So a lot of people look at things like correlations, and of course everybody knows correlation does not equal causation. So then we've got to turn to other methods, the longitudinal methods where you follow people over time and you control confounding, experimental methods where you manipulate people's mood and look at their heart rate or their blood pressure, long-term trying to increase people's mood, make them happier in the long run, and looking at whether it affects different parameters like their cortisol, endocrine hormones, and so forth. So all different things, including animal studies. There's now been, of course, quite a bit of animal work on stress showing that it hurts their health. But with, for example, orangutans, happy orangutans, and that's just judged by the people that take care of them, the zookeepers, live about 11 years longer than the less happy orangutan. So we're looking at all different kinds of evidence to see how it converges, because otherwise, as you know, with smoking, it took a long time to really pin it down to say, yes, beyond a doubt, smoking has an effect. It's not just that people who smoke, because maybe they drink, maybe they're poor, maybe they, you know, do all these other bad things. To get rid of all those other explanations took a long time with smoking, and that's the point we're at now, and I think we've gotten there with all, you know, by triangulating a lot of different methods.
Very comprehensive. Professor Ed Diener joining us on the Roadhouse here. I'm Dave Terstig. We're talking about his new study published in the July issue of Applied Psychology, Health and Well-Being, and he is the co-author. He's a psychology professor from the University of Utah, and he's joining us now talking about subjective well-being. If, when, and why subjective well-being influences health. He's proven it's certain. I think we've talked about the why. How about the when, Ed? Is there certain times
I would say the when is the big question.
Yes.
Because sometimes we find it works for women and not men.
Well, now, this is our theory.
And you find it in young people and not old people. So just imagine, your happiness is going to affect your health when you're young in very different ways. Your accident proneness and your suicide rate, those are the two factors that kill young people more. Probably not going to affect your cardiovascular system yet, because very few 20-year-olds have heart disease, or at least it's not apparent. Now, when you get to 50-year-olds and now the suicide and accident rates drop down, now you start seeing cancer, cardiovascular, et cetera. So in which populations? Another question would be, well, your immune system's more important to your health when you are exposed to a lot of germs. So maybe in third world countries, the immune pathway would be more important. So those are the things we're trying to figure out now. And barely, right now, we're at the point where we've got it, and we say, yes, it does affect these things, but we don't know when very well yet.
Well, now, we've been just talking amongst ourselves on this theory of, you know, mind-body connection, mental health, physical health. Is there one more important than the other? If you're never happy, you'll never be healthy. I mean, explain the mind-body connection you guys are trying to establish.
Yeah, so, you know, it goes both directions. And that is to say, if you're very unhealthy, and especially if it produces pain, and especially if it interferes with activities of daily living, those two things about illness are sometimes more important in influencing your happiness levels than are things like how serious the illness is. It's surprising, but interfering with it makes you not be able to do what you like doing. That really lowers your well-being. Of course, then in turn, it's circular, because your happiness is going to come back and affect your health. So, you know, it can be an upward spiral or a downward spiral. And like anything else, of course, being happy is not going to prevent you from ever getting sick. I mean, it's like eating vegetables and exercising. Those are good for you. They're going to help you on average, but they're not guarantees, and neither is being happy.
Ed, you've been studying happiness for 35 years. Can you will yourself happy? What's the key to being happy?
Well, there's no key. We say there's a recipe, because there's more than one thing. And I think there's a lot of things. For me, one of the things I learned when I was young, I wanted to be, you know, all the things that young people want to be. I wanted to be important and win awards and get recognition or have money and so forth. And what I found over time was all those things are fine. You don't want to be poor, and you don't want to be disrespected. You want those things, but they're not guarantees of happiness. And I found more and more that working toward my goals and have meaningful goals to work for was, at least for me, very important in my ongoing happiness. So once I got an award, say, it didn't make me happy forever, I still had to have new goals. One other thing, Dave, sure, that I'll just mention, though, is we find social relationships, supportive social relationships, but also being a person who gives supportive relationships, those are another thing that really matters importantly to your happiness.
Excellent. Excellent, Ed. Great advice then for folks to set goals, set realistic goals, and maintain social relationships, as subjective well-being will certainly be influenced, and ultimately health. And a fine study, Ed. Now, there's this idea of like a gross national happiness index. I think we've done a past interview concerning this. You know how we measure product and financial health. Is there indexes for national happiness out there? How's the U.S.?
You know, in 2000, I wrote this proposal, National Accounts for Well-Being, and it was kind of out there in the desert, and it's now really catching on. The government of the United Arab Emirates is supporting chapters written about it. The OECD, Office of Economic Cooperation and Development, has studied it and has started sort of pushing it, which is surprising. National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. set up a committee on National Accounts for Well-Being. So we're not saying we're going to replace all economics. We're going to get rid of that. And I mean, some extreme people say, oh, yeah, the economic model's wrong and it degrades the environment and so forth. We don't go to that extreme. We say, no, you know, economic development's important. We want to complement that and give a fuller picture, because the economic measures are good, but they don't measure everything that's important. They don't always measure pollution. They don't measure trust and social capital. And so the well-being measures can be used. Now, in England, they've gotten pretty far with that. They've actually got some measures that are ongoing already, instituted by the government. Many countries, including the U.S., places have measured well-being, like the CDC, Center for Disease Control. But in England, they've actually institutionalized those measures at the level of the national government.
And that now touches on public policy and the government's role in influencing happiness. Do you have some recommendations for...
Well, we think, you know, we get a lot of pushback and arguments against that, why government shouldn't get involved. Of course, governments do get involved in all sorts of ways. They just don't measure happiness and use the happiness measures to see if what they're doing is effective. So we're going through now different areas like the environment, like health, like social relationships, and showing how those things can influence happiness and be measured by the happiness measures separately from economic development. So, for example, data from Costa Rica, a medium-level country, you compare it to Korea, South Korea, a high-income country with several times the income per person, and you'll see that Costa Rica is much happier. How can that be? So the national accounts, you start saying, oh, I see, because they trust each other, they get a lot of support from each other, they're not so critical all the time, they don't feel like failures, et cetera. Sure. You start getting hints about how to improve society.
Hmm. Great stuff, Ed. Great stuff. Any closing comments, recommendations for listeners to check any additional resources online or anything you can recommend for us to
Well,
be happy?
You know, people can look at Wikipedia under my thing or look at my website and get my studies, which is good. And, you know, the one thing I'm going to push now is that healthcare people start measuring well-being along with, you know, for their patients when they give them an exam, along with smoking and the other things they ask you about. That they would be measuring your psychological, not just ill-being like depression, but well-being too.
The mind-body connection. Ed, have you got that web address you want to share? We'll be sure to link it through with this interview, but if you could announce that now, folks can write it down.
Okay, so if you just Google Ed Diener, you're going to pull up Ed Diener Wikipedia. You're going to pull up Ed Diener Internal Psych, which is my website, my personal website. And just click on that. It'll take you there. a couple hundred papers on happiness that we've published over the years on there. And also on there, there are scales to measure happiness, self-report surveys of life satisfaction, flourishing, positive affect, and so forth.
Thank you, Ed. That's Professor Ed Diener, D-I-E-N-E-R. We've been chatting with Ed about his recent review of the studies, If, Why, and When Subjective Well-Being Influences Health and Future Research Needed. So what's next then, Ed? What's the final question is, what's future research is on your horizon?
Well, we're trying to push the policy thing right now. So we're looking for the policy things that governments can do, say in the social capital arena, the health arena, the environment arena, that will have the biggest lever on increasing well-being. In England, the first thing they did was give $1 billion more to mental health, because researchers showed there that of all the illnesses, mental illness is the most underfunded per misery it produces, and it receives very little money compared to cancer and so forth. It just doesn't get the sympathy, and yet mental illness produces the most unhappiness among the person having it as well as their family and friends. So that was the first initiative that came out of this. So we're looking for other initiatives that governments can do now that will be good levers for improving happiness.
Well, thank you, Ed. Keep up the great work
in your
quest for happiness and sharing it with us. Thank you so much for joining us on The Roadhouse. Right.